Let's read together from Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Ecclesiastes is between Proverbs and Isaiah. Psalm, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Isaiah. Ecclesiastes 3. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die. A time to plant, a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to get and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to rend and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time of love and a time of hate. A time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. I know that there is no good in them, for a man, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it, that men should fear before him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. And moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment. The wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, the iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts, and every one befalleth them. As one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All go into one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Ecclesiastes chapter 3.
Our brother has asked for the reading of Acts 3. Acts 3rd chapter. Now Peter and John went up together into the temple at the hour of prayer, being the ninth hour. And a certain man, lame from his mother's womb, was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms of them that entered into the temple. Who, seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, asked an alms. And Peter, fastening his eyes upon him with John, said, Look on us. And he gave heed unto them, expecting to receive something of them. Then Peter said, Silver and gold have I none, but such as I have give I thee. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk. And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up, and immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. And he, leaping up, stood and walked, and entering in with them into the temple, walking and leaping and praising God. And all the people saw him walking and praising God. And they knew that it was he which sat for alms at the beautiful gate of the temple. And they were filled with wonder and amazement at that which had happened unto him. And as the lame man, which was healed, held Peter and John, all the people ran together unto them in the porch that is called Solomon's, greatly wondering. And when Peter saw it, he answered unto the people, Ye men of Israel, why marvel ye at this, or why take ye, look ye so earnestly on us, as though by our own power or holiness we have made this man to walk? The God of Abraham, and of Isaac, and of Jacob, the God of our fathers, hath glorified his Son Jesus, whom ye delivered up to be up and denied him in the presence of Pilate when he was determined to let him go. But ye denied the holy one and the just, and desired a murder to be granted unto you, and killed the Prince of Life, whom God hath raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses. And his name, through faith in his name, hath made this man strong, whom ye see and know. Yea, the faith which is by him hath given him this perfect soundness in the presence of you all. And now, brethren, I wot that through ignorance ye did it, as did also your fathers. But those things which God before had showed by the mouth of his prophets that Christ should suffer, he has so fulfilled. Repent ye, therefore, and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out, when the times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Lord. And he shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you, whom the heaven must receive until the time of restitution of all things which God has spoken by the mouth of all his prophets since the world began. For Moses truly said unto the fathers, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren like unto me. Him shall ye hear in all things whatsoever he shall say unto you. And it shall come to pass that every soul which will not hear that prophet shall be destroyed from among the people. Yea, and all the prophets from Samuel and those that follow after, as many as have spoken, have likewise foretold of these days. Ye are the children of the prophets and of the covenant which God made with our fathers, saying unto Abraham, and in thy seed shall all the kindreds of the earth be blessed. Unto you first, God having raised up his Son Jesus, sent him to you in turning away every one of you from his iniquities. Acts 3.
Well, good morning, and thank you for your attendance and blessing of being here today. We thank you, the Lord, for the opening that we've had this morning. I've had some of those same thoughts, and I appreciate the ability that God gives, if we're honest with ourselves, to look within ourselves. Sometimes we like to look around and see and wonder and question, but I think that if we'll look within ourselves, that's probably the safest place and the place that we can do the most growing and learning. Might have a few more comments on the opening throughout the message. For those of you that don't know this, our family spent the last 2 weeks in Africa. We were over there working with the SALT, Christian Aid Ministries SALT program, and we were in two countries, Uganda and Namibia. And the very different countries. Uganda would be kind of up in the center of Africa. The whole top part of Africa is basically the Sahara Desert, so there's very little happening up there. But just below that would be these countries of Kenya and Uganda. Uganda would be a little bit more toward the east. There's a SALT program that's going on there. So we spent about a week, 5 days, 6 days there. And then we flew down to Namibia. And Namibia is clear down at the bottom. South Africa is clear at the bottom. And Namibia is just above that on the west coast. So it's on the Atlantic Ocean. It's a very dry, desert-like area that we were at there. So we spent the first week in Uganda there. And you know, it's a little bit, many of you have been to these places, and it's a little bit shocking to go to these places and just to see the difference and how people are living and so forth. A lot of what we would call two-room houses, very small. Doesn't get real cold there. It's right on the equator, so the temperature is about the same throughout the year. It's very pleasant temperature-wise. No problem there. But they don't need things like good windows. They don't need doors that seal. They don't need heating systems. They don't really need a lot of the things that we have. And so a lot of their lives are basically lived outside. Of course, there's a lot of poverty and a lot of poor people in these areas. And I guess I didn't really consider the whole implication of all this until we got on the plane. So after about 5-6 days there in Uganda, and we'd been to basically the place where we were was the big city of Kampala. So that's a big city, and about 1 million people, I believe. And And we spent most of our time there. We did get out into the country a little bit, but it's just the effect that that had on us. And we got on the plane and we were traveling about 4 hours south there, flying down to the south part of Africa to visit this program, a new program that's starting in Namibia. And just kind of bored, whatever. And one of my children, Brendan and Bailey, both had their phones out and they were kind of, I don't know what they were doing. We can't really do much on the plane, but I just took one of their phones and then I took the other one, and they both have pretty good phones, so they had pretty good pictures. And just were sort of scanning back through the pictures that they had on their phone. And of course they had a few pictures from that part of the trip at that point. But what really struck me, I guess, were the pictures of here. That will be the inspiration for our message today. I'd like to talk on the subject of beauty. And that's kind of an odd subject maybe, and we hope to get some spiritual lessons and so forth out of that. But as I skimmed through those pictures, I was just comparing in my mind, and I guess when you're stuck in these situations, many of you have been to Haiti in different areas and it's very similar, but you don't really realize in many ways the lack of beauty that is in some of those places. I stood on the seacoast one time down in Haiti, just a beautiful coastline. And the waves were crashing in, and the birds were there. And I asked an American missionary who was living there at the time, I said, do these guys, as referring to the Haitian natives there, I said, do they appreciate this? And he said, you know, they just don't see beauty like we do. They just don't have an appreciation of beauty. But as I scanned through their phones, you know, both of them had been to California camp, and so there was pictures of the beautiful tall pine trees and lots of pictures of young folks and different people, and mostly in color coordinated outfits, and their hair was done and it was neat and tidy, and they had been to get togethers and parties out there where there was decorations and things that they could pose for pictures beside. And even before that, you know, we were at a wedding just a few weeks ago for Jared back here in the yard, and there was beautiful pictures of that, and the beautiful grass and the trees and the flowers that were blooming and the decorations on the table, and on and on and on. And it just struck me as I was looking through these pictures how much beauty is a part of our lives. We just sort of take it for granted. We really do. And I don't know that that's necessarily wrong. I don't know that it's necessarily something that we need to make everything ugly. We live in a beautiful area. We noticed that when we came home. We came from an area that would be a little bit like, I'll say it's a little bit like California, but if you can imagine California without any water that they've brought in. And so if you go to California certain times of the year, there's areas that are green and lush where the weeds or the grass has sprung up on its own when it's getting some rainfall. But if you go to California other times of the year, it's pretty dry and barren. Now, they water the orchards and they water their lawns and they water all these things to keep them alive. But if you can imagine California without water, that's basically what Namibia was. It was a desert. And so I question whether we saw any grass growing from the time we left Uganda to the time that we got home. Now, this is winter time in Namibia. They're in the southern hemisphere. They're way down there. And so it's winter time. And so that would naturally be a little bit less green, a little bit less beauty to see there. So it's a different type of beauty. Even a lot of the trees were barren, as just like our winters, really. They'd be a little bit warmer climate than what we would have here. It was very pleasant there as well during the day. But it just struck me, all of these things, the fertility of the soil that we see around us, and just how, you know, every 10 or 20 acre plot that's not used for something. We don't even really like to graze animals around here, I'll say, because that land can be used for agriculture and can be used for crop production. And it's very profitable and it's very a blessed thing. Don't even have to water the corn. Matter of fact, this year, it sounds like we wish we had just a little bit less water. So ironic. But the beauty that we see around us. And so I just did a little study there, and I want to share that with you this morning on beauty. I want to look at what is biblical beauty. What does God value? What does God care about? He's placed us here. I can't tell you why. He's placed folks over there and they're happy there. They're living. Some of them have had to leave their home country, went to a South Sudanese refugee settlement, and it's a little different than what I expected. I expected more of a camp setting, but it really wasn't. There were little houses there, and the Ugandan government had given each person a little acre, I don't know, maybe an eighth of an acre of land or something like that, and they had little gardens growing, and they were trying to make it as good as they can, but the people were just used to living very simply. And so we are very used to the beauty that is around us. And I don't want to lay some sort of a guilt conviction on us that we need to make things ugly or that we need to go out and spray our lawns with Roundup because they shouldn't be beautiful. It is where we live. But I also want to consider, what does God value? You know, there in Uganda, it was also, they really don't have seasons. We were, I think, at 1 degree above the equator. So they don't really have seasons there. The temperature, the time of day, I think they said varies about 5 minutes to 10 minutes from the longest day of the year to the shortest day of the year. It's right on the equator. But it was fairly dry there, and they have this red dust. And so it's a little like a brick dust, if you think of an orange brick that kind of just coats everything. And I didn't really realize how much that had affected everything until you start looking back at the pictures, and you just sort of see this dust everywhere. And then you come here, and green is just the dominant color. Bailey noticed something kind of interesting with the little children over there in Namibia. When they go to draw, our children, I'm talking little children, would take a green pencil, and they would start to draw the hills and the grass around their home. In Namibia, when a child goes to draw his house, he starts with a brown crayon, because that's what it is. It's just brown. Has its own beauty. It's a desert beauty. So what is biblical beauty? Yeah, I looked up the word beautiful in the Bible, and I want you to follow along if you would. I've got 5 or 6 descriptions of beauty in the Bible. And I'll just tell you, the reason we read Acts 3 is that the gate beautiful. And there was something beautiful that happened at that gate that really had nothing to do with the gate. They called it the temple, the gate to the temple called beautiful. And I even did a little bit of research, and it said that they're not even sure exactly what that was, but it was probably the gate that would have lined up with the eastern gate that went right into the temple. And it talks about Solomon's porches there in that Acts 3. But it was there that man laid. And we have a few thoughts about that as well. We'll share with you later. But that's why we read that chapter. The first, turn with me to Psalm 48, verse 2. So we want to look at what is beautiful in the Bible. So I just, again, just very simply, just looked up this word and did several thoughts here that I want to share with you. So the first thing that God describes, that if we want to understand biblical beauty, God describes, and David here in this psalm, I assume it probably is written by David, is Jerusalem, the Mount Zion. Psalm 48, verse 1 says, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of His holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. On the sides of the north, the city of the great king." Psalm 50, while you're right there, has about the same thought. Psalm 50, verse 1 says, "The mighty God, even the Lord, hath spoken and called the earth from the rising of the sun to the going down thereof. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God hath shined." So what is it about Mount Zion that God finds beautiful? Some of you have been there, and you know, if you're thinking it's Yosemite or something like that, it's not. If you're thinking of beautiful waterfalls or huge trees or beautiful scenery like we might think of in the American West or something, that's not what it looks like at all. I don't really remember exactly. And I remember asking our guide, what is Zion? What is Mount Zion? And as I recall, there's really not a place over there that is Mount Zion. It's sort of all of it together where Jerusalem is. And it's a very nice city as far as that goes. There's some decent agriculture going on there and some amazing inventions that these Jewish people have come up with for agriculture and so forth and different types of irrigation. Is it the topography? Is it the trees? Is it the water? No, it's not. The reason why Zion and Jerusalem is beautiful is because God put his place there. And God led his people into there and he said, this is the place that I have for my people. That's why David says, beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. And I don't even know what kind of a city it had even been at this time. I believe it was called Jebus there, and they talk about David and coming up and going over the water pipes. And so I can just imagine that maybe this was even written before he had even laid eyes on Jerusalem. Probably before it had received its name, no doubt. So what was it? Was it the city? Was it the mountain? Was it the natural beauty? No. It was God's presence there. The second one is found in Ecclesiastes 3, the chapter that we read earlier. And Ecclesiastes 3 just talks about something that is beautiful in verse 3 of the 11th, in the 11th verse of the third chapter. So it starts out the chapter here and it talks about a time for this and a time for that. And some are positive things we might view and some are negative things that we might view. And as Gary said, Solomon comes up with, as he said in his prayer, Solomon comes up with the answer that all is vanity under the sun at the end. But it seems like through the rest of Ecclesiastes, he's really got a question. What's it all for? What's the purpose of this thing? Why are we here? What is God wondering? And so he notices these times, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together, etc., etc., etc. But then, in the 11th verse, he says, he hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning of the end. Now, my Bible says that he hath made everything beautiful in his time. And the thing there in my Bible is italicized, so that means that that probably wasn't part of the original text. And so my Bible says that you could insert the word nature, everything of nature, beautiful in his time. And maybe that's okay, I like that thought. But I just want to point out that by comparison, some things become more beautiful. Now I can't tell you which is more beautiful, a time to cast away stones or a time to gather stones together. And many times these are just depending on the stages of our life, whether it would, the one would be better or the other. But it seems like he's using the technique of comparison here to compare and make some more beautiful. But you know, if all we have is good times, it may be beautiful. But how often do we lose the perspective of that? And I think that's what happened to me on the airplane there. I live here. I've noticed these green fields. I've noticed the green grass. And it really didn't even brown up around our house much this summer. A little unusual. But you know, sometimes that becomes a hassle. Because I think, well, surely I'm going to get a break from lawn mowing one of these times. Or I can just mow part of it. The low spots, the wet spots, I can mow that and I won't have to mow over here and I'll get a little break. And so that beauty is lost on me because I have nothing to compare it to. But if you go out west and you drive through some of the dry areas, even of this country and Utah and Nevada and some of those areas, and you pop back into the Midwest suddenly, and suddenly the green and the green trees and the flourishing life is such a beautiful contrast because you have something to compare it to. And I think that's what Solomon is doing here in Ecclesiastes, is he's comparing the positive to the negative. But you know, we don't always appreciate the positive if that's all we have. And so there's a beauty there in times of negative, in times of growth, in times of seeking the Lord, if you will. Because that makes the times of flourishing and the times of fellowship that Gary talked about a little bit earlier that much more beautiful. I'll just throw this in at this point. I hadn't planned on necessarily talking about, but Gary mentioned fellowship, the beauty of fellowship. The church in Namibia was all at the house that we were, the whole church, minus about 3 or 4 members, I think. And there was 46 of us, and I would guess that about 30 of them were children. And so what you have down there is it's a group that has come out of the Dutch Reformed Church, generally speaking. The Dutch Reformed would be similar to what we would call Catholic or something like that, where they were very ritual-based, very, very mass-oriented and performance and so forth. And so these small group of people have come out of the Dutch Reformed Church, and there's just a handful of them. I think right there in the capital area there where we were, there's maybe 8 or 10 members there of this church. And then about 2.5 hours away, there's about 3 or 4 members there. And about 3 hours out the other direction, there's 3 or 4 members there. And clear up in the north, about 8 hours away, there's about 3 members up there. And I don't know how many adult members there would be in this entire church, but somewhere around 15 to 20. And when one of the men that was over here a few weeks ago was in our home for about a week, he just commented, "I can't believe you don't fellowship more with your brothers and sisters than what you do. We don't fellowship that much during the week. We do get together and we enjoy that. But again, it's what we're comparing it to." That man couldn't imagine having 100 members in one small geographic area that we call Maple Grove. 100 members. Unbelievable. That's 5 times the size of his church right here in this part of the county. And then you just jump over the next one, and that's 100, and the next one's 60 down here, and the next one's 40 up here, and so forth and so on. He couldn't imagine that fellowship that we can enjoy. And so that's another beautiful thing, I think, that we take for granted, and we just don't understand and don't realize the blessing of what we have. And then it's not just us. It's not just our group. There's other Christian groups that we are with and that we can associate with and are very similar in doctrine and practice as we are. And we appreciate each one of them. But everything is beautiful in its time, and it may be what you compare it to. Let's look at another one. Let's look at Isaiah 4, verse 2. Sometimes Isaiah is a little bit hard to understand exactly what it's referring to. Is it referring to something that has already happened? Is it referring to something that's yet in the future for us? But I'll start in verse 1. "In that day, 7 women shall take hold of one man, saying, 'We will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach.' And in that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious. For the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped out of Israel." And so I don't know exactly prophetically what that is all referring to, but I just caught this phrase in there, the branch of the Lord, or the branch of salvation. And I think that's referring to Christ. And so it's referring to a time of famine, and it's referring to time. I don't know where all the men are. I don't know why 7 women need to take hold of one man, but maybe there was a war. Maybe there was a famine there. But somehow, in order to avoid their own reputation going down the tubes, they asked to be called by one man's name. And then Christ, the branch of salvation, appears in there. And how beautiful that would be, again, comparatively speaking. Not just compared to the destitution of verse 1. I don't know that we necessarily have to be destitute to find Christ beautiful, but we certainly would if we were in that situation. Isaiah 52 is the next one. And this is an odd one. You probably maybe thought of it already. It's also mentioned in Romans 10. Isaiah 52 verse 7 says this: "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth." Beautiful there are feet. Now, I don't know, maybe that's referring to the feet of Christ. I don't know. We don't read in the New Testament that his feet were anything that specially glorious necessarily. Romans is a little bit different. Let's turn to Romans 10 It's sort of the same thought, and I think it's quoting this Isaiah 52 there in Romans 10. But isn't that how God works? We think we know exactly what beauty is, and he throws in something like feet. Romans 10:15, it says, "And how shall they preach except they be sent? It is written, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring good tidings, glad tidings of good things." What kind of feet would that be? I would say that it's sent feet. It says the feet of those that preach the gospel. And certainly there are a few of us here who are employed in preaching the gospel. But I would expand this out quite a bit. And I would say that as we move around our communities, as we go into more challenged communities, that we can be part of this beautiful feet, all of us. Not just those who are called to ministry. They're sent feet. They're faithful feet. They're feet who have been walking the road. Now, we pretty much cover our feet up for the most part. But imagine in these times, feet that were sticking out of sandals a little bit. That were a little dusty with the road, that maybe had a few sore spots and calluses because the shoes didn't fit quite right. Feet that maybe had been walking a little extra far to find someone to share the good news with. Those would be beautiful feet, faithful feet, and feet that reach toward the unhearing, that reach toward those who don't want to know about the gospel. Beautiful feet. So we've got Jerusalem. We've got everything in its time. We've got Christ, the branch of salvation, and we've got feet. Now let's look at a thought of false beauty. Matthew 23 has the thought of false beauty. And it's a warning unto the Pharisees, I believe it is. Yeah, Matthew 23, verse 27 says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." Matthew 23, 27. "For ye are like unto whited sepulchres," that's the place where you bury a dead person, "which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead man's bones and all uncleanness." And so Jesus here is telling them that it is possible to be false on the outside and to present a beautiful appearance on the outside and a beautiful countenance and a beautiful character, but inside we can have hatred. I don't know, Gary spoke of some Hindus, I believe it was. And, you know, someone that is fully enlightened in that religion, it might appear very peaceful and very serene on the outside, but I just wonder at the turmoil that might be going on within. He calls them whited sepulchres. And if you can imagine just a beautiful place of burial. Now, we would pretty quickly recognize that that's a place of burial, and I don't really want to go in there. Thank you. But it's like this place of burial has been concealed and has been made so beautiful that it draws people into it. And you get in there and you realize it's just a place of dead men's bones. And you've been tricked. And you've been deceived. Because it's false beauty. It is possible to be deceived by beauty. We'll talk about that a little bit more. The next one we want to consider is found in Psalm 96. Psalm 96, verse 9, says something like this. "O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness." Excuse me. "Fear before him all the earth." Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. I don't know what that means to you, how you would label that beauty of holiness there that psalm talks about, but I would just say it's a consistent lifestyle. That's a lifestyle that is not a whited sepulcher on the outside and full of dead men's bones on the inside. That's a lifestyle that maybe doesn't even polish the sepulcher all that much on the outside, but inside is consistent. And as people get to know us, and as they come into our homes, and as they consider us, not just on Sunday morning, but throughout the week as well, they realize that there is consistency there. It's a beautiful holiness, and we're worshiping the Lord in the beauty of holiness. And the last one that we want to consider is found in Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53, and this is just Christ's character. You could probably quote this if you wish, But Isaiah 53:2 says, "For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness or beauty. And when we should see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him." So what was it that drew people to Christ? Was it his outward beauty? Psalm 53 says, no, he wasn't all that handsome of a man. I'm sure he was a handsome man. I don't want to take anything away from him. But the point is that's not what drew people. What drew people to him was the consistency of his character. Isaiah 33 says it a little bit differently, but it has about the same thought. Isaiah 33 verses 15 through 17 says, "He that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly, he that despiseth the gain of the oppressions, that shaketh his hands from holding a bribe, that stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood and shutting his eyes from seeing evil, he shall dwell on high. His place of defense shall be munitions of rocks. Bread shall be given him. His waters shall be sure. Thine eyes shall see the king in his beauty." And so what that's saying to me is that he that walketh uprightly will be spared. And it says that we may have to hide in the desert, and that we may see someone taking a bribe, and we're offered a bribe, and we know that that's wrong, and we're made to flee somehow. I don't know exactly the scenario that this is portraying here. But it says that even as we're hiding in the desert, and think of Elijah hiding in the desert and the ravens feeding him, it says that God will sustain us even in that situation. That's the promise. And he will see the king in his beauty and behold the land that is very far off. And so the man that is pure in his character, or the woman, will be sustained by God. Now, it may not look exactly like we think it should or we think it would, but we will be sustained. Let's talk about for a couple of minutes here Satan's pollution of beauty or some dangers. One of the things we did as we were in Namibia there was went to an animal reserve. And I think in my mind of a reserve is like a zoo. And this was a little bit like that, but in another way very different, because there's just acres and acres of this reserve. As a matter of fact, we drove 14 kilometers back off the main road, about 10 miles, to get to this reserve. And I think the whole thing was the reserve. So it was quite large. But one of the things that they did as we were back there on this reserve, we wanted to see some animals maybe as we went over there, was we went out in some jeeps with some kind of setting up high, as you might think of it, in a safari car. And we drove out there about three or four cars of us, and we went out to see him feed the big cat. And the one that we saw that I'm going to speak of, I guess, was the leopard. And so we pulled around there, and as we went through a couple series of gates, and they would open and close the gates and the pretty high fences, but then as you got in there, it felt really open and wild, I guess, if you will. And we parked those cars there, and the men in one of the first cars had some meat. And they were going to feed the leopard. And so here comes the leopard. And we were all very quiet and watching, and as that big cat moved through the tall grass. The grass is about 3 foot tall, and his shoulders would just barely stick out. A leopard's a big cat. I would guess this leopard weighed about 250 pounds. This is a big animal. And we're sitting in there in these cars, and you know, you just kind of do what they tell you to do. Don't stick your hand out, and don't, you know, make any sharp noises and so forth. And you don't really realize that probably between here and that window is a 250-pound killing machine. And that leopard kind of slunk through the grass there, and he was just walking. He knew what he was there for. He wasn't any big surprise to him. He was just there for the free meat. But he was very well camouflaged. The grass was kind of a light tan color, wintertime, think of it. And the spots you could see on the leopard as he came through there, and just muscles, and they put a little bit up a tree, and that cat was up in that tree in a flash. And got the meat out of that tree, and then they fed him a little more on the ground. And then we went to another little place there, and they fed some cheetahs. And they were beautiful cats, too, a lot skinnier, maybe almost as tall, but a lot skinnier at the shoulder and at the hip, and not big and bulky and muscular like that leopard was. And these were a little tamer. It still scared me just a little bit, the way they were treating these things, because I thought they were just fairly casual with them. But the cheetahs, of course, are known for intense speed. And they can run and they can chase, I forget, 60 miles an hour maybe in short bursts that they can chase down an antelope or some sort of a wild animal and kill it. And I just had to think the beauty of those cats there. Just the way that God had made them. And if you, it's really amazing. I was looking at our little cat the other day as once we got home and just looking at the bone and the muscle structure. It's very, very similar. Just take that little cat and just multiply it times about 20. And that's basically exactly what it is. But you can imagine, you know, our cat, there's a window in our garage that's about 6-7 feet tall, something like that. And our cat can go from the ground to that window in a minute. Just a second. Just pop right up there. Can you imagine what this 250-pound cat can do with one leap? Incredible design by God. But then, you know, I talked to a farmer. And he was a farmer there. He's got, they go in hectares, and it's a little bit different. But I figured it's about 20,000 acres this man farms. And it's not farming like we think of as farming. It's grazing ground. And so it's deserty and it takes a tremendous amount of land area to support an animal. They can't crowd the cows into a nice green pasture like we can around here because the food is very sparse. So on this 20,000 acres, this man had about, I think maybe about 500 cows and about 350 sheep on this huge expanse of land. And he said, yeah, they've got cats in his area and they're a problem. The cheetahs are especially the worst one. He said one year they figured the four farms in his area, the four farmers all got together and they were having a big problem with cheetahs that year. And they figured that cheetahs had killed 250 sheep in those four farms that year. Beautiful animals. Intensely powerful, fast, but so destructive. And he said, the problem with a cheetah is that it'll come into your flock of sheep and it'll kill five sheep and just eat a little portion of one of them. It'll come in at night. And so they were not big fans of the cheetahs. They knew they were beautiful. They knew they were powerful, but there was danger there. And I just want to compare that a little bit as we consider beauty and how Satan has polluted beauty. And one way that Satan has polluted beauty is that he has said, beauty is the goal. Especially for young people, he whispers in our ear, beauty is the goal. How many times have you walked through the first 100 feet of a department store at the mall? You come in through the mall, and what do you walk through first? It's 100 feet or more of makeup counter. And there's ladies there dressed a certain way and they want you to sit down and get your hair and your makeup done just right. I suspect because it's big business and I suspect because there's a lot of money that's going into those little tubes of lipstick and so forth. And so if they can get you to consider and believe that beauty is the goal, they've made sale after sale for a long time. But beauty is not a goal. Because it's not satisfying. It's elusive. It's never quite good enough. The second pollution that we want to consider is that beauty is not lasting. And so, you know, we talked about all these things of beauty in the first part, and it used the word beautiful and so forth. But I guess what I want to switch our minds a little bit now is when I'm referring to beauty in this section, I'm referring to outward appearance. And I want to compare and contrast the outward appearance to the true character of the heart. And that's what God wants in us, I believe. Proverbs 31, verse 30, has a thought on this that we want to consider. This is, of course, about the woman who takes care of her family, and it's a beautiful account here. But Proverbs 31, 30 says, favor is deceitful and beauty is vain. But a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Favor or charm is deceitful. And beauty is vain or transitory. It kind of comes and goes. Many of us have probably our peak beauty in our late teen and our early 20s, maybe into our 30s. Some are beautiful for much longer than that. But beauty is not lasting. Beauty is just a temporary thing. I sat at my computer there as I was putting this message together, and the Maple Grove calendar sits there on the desk there. And this month, there's a picture of our late sister Esther here, and they had some sort of a contest, a fall contest, I believe it was, if I remember right, and they selected a queen of the festival. And so here sits Esther with this little sheepish look on her face, and they've got this fake crown up on her head, and she looks a little funny, to be honest with you. But I just had to look at that picture, and it's kind of a humorous little picture there of Esther. And those of you that know her, you can just pick the mischievousness of her character in that picture. It's a neat picture. But I just had to look at that old soul. I forget what she was in her 90s when she died. And there was really very little there that you would say was physical beauty. But yet that woman's character and the beauty of her person even shines through the picture. And I think that's what God is after here. There was probably a time in many of our lives as we get older when we would be considered beautiful or nice to look at or whatever you want to put that at. But if we do not use that and develop character and sincerity of character, it's all a waste. There's another one. It's Proverbs 20 that talks to the men as well. And we want to consider that one. Proverbs 20:29 says something like this: "The glory of young men is their strength, and the beauty of old men is the gray head." And so, as women struggle with pride in beauty, so men struggle with pride in strength. And we all want to be strong men. We want to be emotionally strong. We want to be physically strong. We want to be the boy at the party that can do the most push-ups. We want to be the young man whose arms are chiseled and just strong to look at. But it says that that's not going to last either. It says that those muscles, as we age, they're going to sort of go away. I'm not sure where they go. They're going to atrophy. They're going to get flabby. It's not going to be that attractive. But it says the gray head. Now, that is a beautiful thing. And we in America don't really follow that logic very well. We don't think gray hair is really all that attractive for the most part. But I think the thought of the writer of Proverbs here is that the man who is aged and experienced and wise is to be honored above the man who has a strong arm. And so it's similar to beauty in that, but it can all be motivated by pride. And that's the danger that Satan has taken, and he's polluted this thing. And so we can spend our lives, you know, you look at ads, and it's all about, we talked about the makeup counter at the mall, and how it's all about anti-aging this, and it's all about getting your natural hair color back and all these things. And for men, you know, it's the picture of the 60 or 70 year old man that's worked out and he's still fit. And that's the ultimate is presented in the world's view, but it's based on pride. And I think we know that. And so I want to encourage us that it's just about character. Beauty is not an exterior condition. What did we talk about beauty just a minute ago? We talked about Jerusalem. We talked about feet. We talked about a time to weep. Are those beautiful in our minds? Beauty is not an exterior condition. Beauty is a strength of character. Let's consider this just a little bit, this man in Acts chapter 3. We've got a couple more sections here, and then we'll soon take our seat in a little while. Acts chapter 3, the gate beautiful. I don't know how many of you have been to Jerusalem, have been up on that Temple Mount, but there's no gate beautiful there. Oh, they might be able to predict or tell you about where that thing would have stood and the temple would have been over here. And they can sort of paint the picture in your mind, or you can go to the model city and you can see a model of what it might have been. But the gate beautiful is gone. And Acts chapter 3 talks about it, but it really doesn't matter. It's about the man that was at the gate beautiful, not the gate beautiful. And so what was eternal in that story? Was it the gate? No, it's gone. Was it the temple? 70 AD, I think maybe what, 40 years after this was written, or after this story took place, something like that, that thing was leveled. And so all of this natural and man-made beauty was gone. But you know what lives on? There's three things I thought about in that story. And so the story there, you probably remember the story, is that the man looks up at Peter and John as they walk by, and he asks an alms of them. And he said, "Silver and gold have I none, but such as I have I give to you. In the name of Jesus of Nazareth, rise up and walk." And so there's three things that's eternal there. First of all is the soul of that man. It's eternal. It's still somewhere. The gate's gone. The temple's gone. The city is much, much different than it was back then. But that man's soul is still living. The second thing there is the story and the miracle done by Peter and John. And it says that story, the miracle, I think it says in Acts 4 that 5,000 people. Now, there were some other things that went into that story and their testimony and so forth. But 5,000 people believed because of that story. Now, I don't know if that was in addition to the 2,000 on the day of Pentecost. So it was actually just 3,000 additional, or if it was 5,000 additional. But the point is, that's a phenomenal amount of people. 5,000 people. The time was right. God was working. And Peter and John were faithful. But that story and that miracle led to the conversion of 3,000 to 5,000 people. That's eternal. That lives on. And the third thing is the power that raised him up. Temple's gone. The gate's gone. The man's long been dead in a physical sense. But the power that raised him up is still there. And it is available for us today. I want to speak of the opening just one more time here. You know, I can get a little bit discouraged or feel sorry for that little church in Namibia that's so spread out. They get together about 3 times a year. Travel and the distances and so forth, that's about the only times that their whole church can be together, 3 times a year. And so I can be very discouraged. They do put their sermons on the internet, and so the people that are in the distance areas can follow along each Sunday. I can be a little discouraged about that and think, man, how would you ever become together as a fellowship if you're that spread out? But I just wrote down a note that Gary spoke of, the beauty of the working of the Spirit of God, that he came across in the opening. He might not have said it quite in those words, but that's just the way I jotted it down. And my encouragement is that we are enjoying something very special here today of worship together. But if it would happen to be the case that we would be spread out, the Spirit of God is what will truly bind us together. And so it is with those people over there. You know, they're spread out, but when they come back together and they are knit together, they don't waste time on corn and beans. It's about knitting together in the Spirit of God. So I just have 4, 5, and 6 encouragements here, I guess, I want to just give just some practical application to this thought of beauty and having a proper perspective of beauty. And the first one is just this: have an eternal perspective. This beauty is temporary. The soul is eternal. I would just like to encourage us today to have an eternal perspective. You know, that man there that sat at the gate beautiful, his soul lives on somewhere. We don't know the end of that man. We don't know. He certainly had a good beginning. But if he went away from that scene just thankful that he could walk again, he missed a lot. He missed everything. If he just went away from that thing just rejoicing that his leg bones were healed and that everything was going to be fine for him from now on, he missed it all. The power that made that happen is the eternal thing. And so it is with us. If we create in our minds an admiration for beauty and we miss the eternal perspective, we too have missed it all. The second one is this: I would like to encourage us to reach into ugliness to share beauty. There is so much ugliness around us. There really is. We don't have to go very far and we find broken homes. We find children that don't know really who their daddy is. We find marriages that are a mess and they're either living separately or they're in the same home but they don't get along and they go their separate ways as much as possible. There is ugliness around us. And I would like to encourage us as a people who know true biblical beauty to reach into that ugliness as we have opportunity. And I think if the only thing that we can share with those people is hope, I think we've done a lot. You know, these children grow up and they look at relationships and they look at their parents and they look at their grandparents and they look at their friends' parents and they think, why even get married? Why even bother? Let's just live together. It's probably not going to work. But if we can help them see hope, we have done a tremendous amount. The third one is this: model and share true beauty. And so I'd just like to encourage us as a people that we have a beautiful perspective on marriage. We have a beautiful perspective on family life and the proper structure of a family with the father leading out and the mother following on behind and the children. And I know it doesn't happen in every situation, and there's difficulties even among us. But as much as possible, I would just like to encourage us to share this true beauty and don't let people miss the beauty of a biblically based family. Our families are probably our best witness for the Lord Jesus Christ that we have. The next one is this: I would just like to encourage us to speak of beauty, to recognize it nearby. And maybe that's just coming home from a trip where we've been someplace that's a little bit ugly. I think we all experience it in the springtime. We've been through the wintertime, the snow, the trees without leaves, the cold weather, and then those flowers start to burst forth. And we speak of God's beauty, and it's a beautiful thing. It really is. And it could be an inspiration. And we want to be careful that we are giving glory to God when we do that. And I just want to encourage us in that to speak of beauty and recognize it nearby. The next one is to exhibit appreciation, but not over attachment to beauty. You know, beauty can be a fleeting thing. We've spoke of that. It can be a thing that we can put way too much focus on. And that doesn't mean that we don't appreciate it. That doesn't mean that we don't plant flowers at our homes. That doesn't mean that we let our lawns get big and ugly. That doesn't mean that we don't comb our hair in the mornings and take care of ourselves. I think that we need to have an appreciation of beauty, but not get overly attached with it. Because people will see that. And they'll see that whited sepulcher. They'll see that image on the outside that's one of eternal perspective. And they'll look through there and they'll see those dead bones. Be careful with that. Be careful of beauty as an idol. I heard a saying one time that I really like, that if a young girl is not pretty at 18, it's not her fault. But if a woman is not beautiful at 50, it is her fault. Character, brothers and sisters, that's what God cherishes. And the last one is simply this: encourage inner beauty, not man's modification of the exterior. Men have so many ways, plastic surgeries and makeups and dyes and colors and enhancements here and enhancements there of modifying the exterior. But I think we, especially as fathers and men, we need to establish within, especially our daughters, I'll say, the purpose of godly character and the beauty that is within every one of them. And if we only compliment them on their clothes or their hair, are we possibly sending the message that that's what's most important to us? Do we give the same amount of comment and affirmation of their character, and even more, really, and our wives as well? I would just like to encourage us to encourage inner beauty within one another. We live in a beautiful area. We have a beautiful fellowship. Even the singing today, we've enjoyed that. We missed that as we traveled. And God bless us as we develop and continue to improve an eternal perspective in the area of beauty. God bless you.